session number 7266, reel 1.
General Lloyd, reel 1. General, firstly, can I ask you why it was that you joined the Territorial Army?
I'm pretty clear about this. What one could say, I think, was some justification that there was no particular reason. It was more historical than anything else. I first became conscious of the world during World War One, and my early introduction to the world was between 1918 and the time when I went to Cambridge. And during this whole period, people of my generation had the feeling that the end of World War One was certainly not the end of warfare, but it was merely an introduction to an inevitable Second World War. In fact, the whole of my childhood and early manhood was overshadowed by this feeling of imminent war. And when Chamberlain came back from Germany in 1939, to people of my generation, I think it was crystal clear that war was imminent. Therefore, I had been in the officers' training corps at school, which in my case was Brighton Grammar School. This, of course, within the days of the not as now a combined cadet force, but the OTC. We were affiliated to the 4th Battalion of the Royal Sussex Regiment. I became Regimental Sergeant Major of the School Corps, which was the highest rank that a cadet could hold. When I went to Cambridge, I transferred to the senior OTC and joined the artillery unit attached to Cambridge. And when eventually I came and lived in Sussex, of course, it was a natural progression to take a yeomanry commission in the Sussex Yeomanry. So that you could say that my commission in the Territorial Army was not so much the result of a conscious division, a conscious decision, but a matter of inevitable progression.
Can I ask you a little bit about the early training that you did? Now, you were in the OTC at school. What sort of training did you do?
Well, that was purely infantry training. But it led to, in those days, to sitting for an examination, which, as you probably know, was called Certificate A. And the syllabus for Certificate A in those days, once one became fairly senior in the Corps, that is the rank of Sergeant or Sergeant Major, involved a knowledge of not only infantry tactics, but also the operation of artillery and the operation of engineers and signals. So that by the time I was a Sergeant Major, I had not any great detail, of course, but I had some knowledge of the operation of other arms. At Cambridge, if I could just go straight on to that, at Cambridge, in my case, the training was entirely confined to the operation of field artillery.
Why did you choose to go into the artillery when you were at Cambridge?
Well, I had taken first of all, a mathematics degree, and then after that, a physics degree. And, of course, if one has those sort of academic qualifications, the arms that one considers in the army... By the way, I would have chosen the Navy if I'd had a chance, but I was debarred from that and the Air Force by reason of our eyesight, which has always been a problem with me. So I've worn spectacles since I was about 8 years old. So that it was natural for me, the army being the only service open to me, it was natural, having a maths degree and a physics degree, to opt for the artillery. I'm not aware that that one had an option to go into the engineers, but there may have been that chance, but it certainly wasn't given to me.
What sort of training did you do at Cambridge?
Well, we were armed with 18-pounders. The OTC had an 18-pounder battery. And I remember that we got as far as going to Lark Hill and firing live shell while I was there. But I believe my memory is correct when I say that there was only an opportunity once every other year to fire live shell. Otherwise, the training was confined to barrack room drill and such mobile operations as one can do in the countryside immediately around Cambridge.
What sort of mobile operations were they?
Well, they usually involved an artillery battery in support of an infantry regiment. And certainly in the light of subsequent knowledge, they were not of any considerable depth or breadth.
Did you actually go out on schemes with infantry?
Yes, we did. Sometimes, very seldom with a fully constituted infantry regiment, usually with what was called in those days a TOOT, that is, a tactical exercise without troops. That is to say, there would be a skeleton battalion headquarters with officers and signalers and company commanders and possibly an adjutant with skeleton signal communication. There was no radio in those days, so all the communication would be by wire.
So it was all chiefs and no Indians?
That's right, that's right.
Did you ever conceive of becoming a regular soldier?
Yes, I did, but when you realise that I was born in 1906, so that by the time World War I was over, I was 14 in 1918, and by the time I was considering coming down from Cambridge, if you look back in history, you'll find that entry to the Army, to Air Force, the Navy and the Civil Service was pretty well reserved for ex-service people from World War I. So that the possibilities of entry into any form of public service, which includes the regular army, was very restricted for a person of my age. At a guess, I would say that it's the first time I've had to think deeply about this. At a guess, I can remember the period very vividly because it was the period when I was considering what I should do with my life. And certainly, as you seem to have guessed, I was very carefully considering joining the regular army, but I don't think that it ever seriously arose because of the obvious difficulties of getting a place. Quite unlike, of course, the situation today.
But you do seem to have been very keen on military activity.
Oh, yes, I was very keen indeed. And, in fact, as you know, of course, by now, that whatever else I got into, I I was always in the yeomanry or the territorial army.
And so you went into the yeomanry when you came down from Cambridge?
That's right, yes, that's right. I ought to explain, by the way, that I was up at Cambridge a lot longer than usual. I became a junior don, in fact, and I didn't come down from Cambridge until about 1933.
By which time Hitler was coming to power in Germany.
By which time Hitler was coming to in Germany, as you say. And, of course, my feeling that war was inevitable was, of course, reinforced by his coming to power.
So you were alert to the effects of Hitler on the international situation from the very first instance, yes.
Which was not a feeling, by the way, shared by probably the majority of people in this country at that time.
You do seem to have been rather early.
Yes, yes.
With your realisation.
Yes, I remember vividly the arguments that used to take place at that time, you know, as to the possibilities of peace or the probability of war and so on.
So you came down to Sussex in 1933 and then you joined the 57th Field
Regiment. Yes.
What did the organisation of that field regiment look like at the time?
Well, I think we were obviously a very good regiment indeed because we won the King's Cup three times running. I say times because it was only the competition was only held every other year, so that winning occupies a period of about 6 years. There were four batteries in the regiment in those days. We had two 18-pounder batteries in Brighton, which were at full strength. We had an 18-pounder battery at Hove, which was at full strength. I lived for a while with my parents in Worthing, where we had a 4.5-inch howitzer battery, and that was at full strength. We were fully equipped with guns, all, of course, World War I guns. Our own guns, strangely enough, were 4.5-inch howitzers, which were of Austrian construction, of all things, which we took over from World War I.
These were booty, were they, at the end of the war?
Pardon?
These
booty.
Were booty.
Yes, booty, yes. Yeah. The 4.5-inch howitzer, if I might digress for a moment, somebody might be interested in this, was, in my opinion, a very, very fine weapon, even by modern standards. But in retrospect, it's extremely interesting to note that the tactical employment of the 4.5-inch howitzer was just about what the modern army does with a 3-inch mortar. And when you think that the mortar is in the possession of the infantry and we were supposed to be operating from about 6 miles behind the infantry lines and the artillery, it shows a sort of concertining, I don't know whether that's the right word, by which I mean that the functions that in World War I were attributed to the Royal Artillery have now, in the present day and age, become absorbed into the infantry battalion itself, which has its own heavy mortars. I don't know what the modern calibre is, I suppose. Perhaps you know. It's a 4-inch, I think, isn't it?
Those are the heavy ones.
The heavy ones, yes.
You say that it was a fine weapon. What made it a fine weapon? What characteristics stand out in your mind?
Well, it had... this, again, of course, is a personal estimate. It had a very, very high degree of accuracy. That's the first thing about it. It's 100% zone at a range of 6 to 7 miles was, I think, only about 50 yards, which for a weapon in those days was absolutely remarkable accuracy. That meant, of course, that 90% of all rounds fired at a certain range, let's say it was 7,000 yards, would fall within a distance of between 7,000 and 50 yards, no, 7,000 and 25 yards, and 6,995 yards from the target, which was, you know, a 50% zone, as I say. Splendid.
So you could achieve a very good concentration.
Oh, yes, very high degree of accuracy.
What sort of rate of fire could you get out of it?
Well, it, again, digressing a bit, one loaded the shell and the charge separately. I'll answer your question in a moment. The other advantage was that it had five charges. So that, and the charges were contained within the brass charge case, which was loaded separately from the shell. It meant that the trajectory ranged from an angle of 45 degrees to the horizontal down to an angle of about 5 degrees from the horizontal. I think we used to get off 4 rounds to the minute, depending on the angle of fire. What one has to remember is that loading a howitzer at full elevation meant that in order to load the shell and the charge, one had to disconnect the piece, bring it up to the horizontal, and then load, and then push the piece down again to an angle of 45 degrees until it connected, before one could fire. And that, of course, is a restrictive operation, which still applies today, incidentally. The ultra-modern high-angle self-propelled gun, its rate of fire is entirely dependent on the angle at which the piece is elevated. And the higher the elevation, the slower is the rate of fire. Okay. Now, what was it you asked me? I've forgotten for a moment.
It was about the rate of fire, which you just...
Oh, the rate of fire. Well, I've answered that, haven't I, now?
How many men would you have on each gun?
Seven. There would be... well, this was what, you know, the establishment was seven. I think we usually went into action in those days with five or six. There would be a loading number. There would be a traversing number. That is the man swinging the piece from side to side. There would be a gun layer, the man on the sights, and there would be a number one who was a bombardier or above, and he would be in charge of the gun. That's four. Then there would be an ammunition number and two spares. They were called limber numbers because their job was to fetch ammunition from the limbers and put them ready for loading behind the gun. But the gun could, in fact, be operated by as few as four men in emergency.
How many of these guns were there in the battery?
Six in my day. Six. There were six 18-pounders in the 18-pounder batteries and six 4.7 Howes in the howitzer battery. I believe, although I'm not sure, I believe the number was subsequently reduced to 4 per bedroom. But it's 6 in my day.
So you were in 3 sections of 2 howitzers each?
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Now, you mentioned the tactical employment. I would assume that the main tactical employment was the support of infantry in the assault.
Yes, it was, yes. Yes. We had no no role like the medium artillery had, for example, in counter-bombardment or anything of that sort. But, of course, a 4.7 howitzer battery was liable to be used for all sorts of special jobs. We were particularly effective in demolition work, for example, against a concrete emplacement, because we could bring the shells down and as near as not to a rate of descent, an angle of descent of 80 degrees, which, of course, made for very high penetration.
Did you do a lot of practice in direct fire?
Most of our howitzer battery was indirect fire. And that's why, of course, as a mathematician, I liked it so much. It was all work off a map and indirectly.
So you would do shoots by mathematical calculation off a map?
That's right.
That must have involved very careful surveying to get your own position worked
out.
Oh,
yes,
exactly.
It did. Yes, it did, yes, yes. And also, of course, one even had to take into account things such as air temperature and that sort of thing. We had to use balloons on occasion.
To take the wind and...
The wind and air temperature. A howitzer shell goes up a very considerable way, and its line of flight is very much affected by... It's comparatively slow, and its line of flight is very considerably affected by atmospheric conditions. Not only temperature, but also humidity.
What about firing with spotters? Did you do much of that?
Well, a fair amount. Of course, my active service with the guns was pretty early on when air spotting was at its infancy. But I myself have been up in a plane and done spotting for a battery. I'm quite familiar with it, although in our days, of course, we used to look down between our knees and look through the bottom of the aeroplane. However, it was very accurate indeed.
Did you have much opportunity to do live firing with the Sussex Yeomanry?
Well, every second year, we used to go to the ranges were Lark Hill, Salisbury Plain, Oakhampton in Devon. We were, of course, in those days horse-drawn, and we used to embark our guns from Worthing, and we used to take a night troop train down to Oakhampton, where we were allotted a complete battery's worth of horses. And we had to haul the guns up that agonising hill from Oakhampton up onto the up to the moor. However, we went round there down there several times, and the other place we used to go was Trowse Finnith, where the nuclear power station is in the middle of Wales now. In those days, it was an artillery range.
Besides your camps for shooting, did you do camps for manoeuvring with other arms of the service?
Yes. The firing camps, as we used to call them, took place every second year. And also, every second year in between whiles, we went to camp all over the place, and always with, excuse me, always in conjunction with other arms. And we used to practice various tactical situations, but none above brigade level. The most that I ever heard of an artillery battery ever engaging in was brigade level. More often than not, it was at battalion level with a battalion of infantry. In our case, it was usually the Royal Sussex Regiment. And when I was a major and took the promotion examination, the company commander of the Royal Sussex Regiment at that time was the late Duke of Norfolk, who I think was mobilised in 1939 with that battalion of the Royal Sussex. However, to answer your question, it was usually at battalion level, but sometimes at brigade level.
What sort of men did you have in the regiment?
Well, the quality of men that we had in the yeomanry was very high indeed. In fact, when they examined the Territorial Army for officer-producing units, of course, the yeomanry was reckoned to be an officer-producing unit. And that also had its effect on mobilisation in 1939, because so many of the units, which had been, like our own, which had been operationally highly trained, of course, became, I don't know what the word is, debilitated by the transfer of so many men from the unit to officer training units, thus reacting against its operational efficiency.
Now, I believe you went to Staff College as a yeomanry officer.
Yes. It was I went to the very first staff course that was ever set up